Sojourner Truth translates into itinerant preacher, which she was. Right. And she was one of about 80 women who were itinerant preachers before the Civil War. Most of them were white, but some of them were black. Sojourner Truth, Joanna Lee, Zilpha Elaw. So when we humanize Sojourner Truth, some people find it diminishing. But what I'm trying to do in my book is to give back some of those other women, as well as showing what is representative about Sojourner Truth.
Historian Nell Irvin Painter, for Black History Month 1997, she's here to talk about her new book, Sojourner Truth, the life story of one of America's noteworthy African-American women. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Later on the program this week, literary critic and biographer John Sikora. He'll be here to talk about his new book, a biography of Frederick Douglass, another prominent 19th century African-American leader. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products.
Sojourner Truth, born Isabella, is one of the two most famous African-American women of the 19th century. The other, Harriet Tubman, the Moses of her people, also came out of slavery. Many people confuse the two because both lived in an era shadowed by human bondage. A woman of remarkable intelligence despite her illiteracy, Truth had great presence. She was tall, some 5'11", of spare but solid frame. Her voice was low, so low that listeners sometimes termed it masculine, and her singing voice was beautifully powerful. Whenever she spoke in public, she also sang. No one ever forgot the power and pathos of Sojourner Truth's singing, just as her wit and originality of phrasing were also of lasting remembrance. As an abolitionist and feminist, she put her body and her mind to a unique task, that of physically representing women who had been enslaved. At a time when most Americans thought of slaves as male and women as white, Truth embodied a fact that still bears repeating. Among the blacks are women, among the women there are blacks.
Historian Nell Irvin Painter. Her new book is Sojourner Truth, subtitled A Life, a Symbol. Nell Painter says that in writing her book, a primary challenge was understanding the differences between the historical record and the myths that have grown up around the life of Sojourner Truth. Nell Irvin Painter is a professor of history at Princeton University.
The first thing is that the Sojourner Truth that we inherit, that we know today, is a symbolic figure. Mm-hmm. She stands for something. She stands for strong black women. She stands for strong American women. She stands for American women who work. And she also is a symbol for black people interested in black civil rights, that there were black women mm-hmm. in the struggle. And for women involved in feminism or what was then called women's rights, that there were black women involved. And that's still important for us today. So she, particularly her picture, says, I'm interested in women's studies, and I know that women's studies is not simply Lily White.
Fair enough. Let's talk about some specifics here as you come to this large proposition of the symbolic nature of the life of Sojourner Truth. Tell us quickly about the famous speech, Ain't I a Woman? Aren't I a Woman? It did or did not happen. You basically come down and say, no, it is a fabrication, but that doesn't make it any less valuable.
Oh, Wayne, I don't know how I'm going to talk about this in 2 minutes, but I'll certainly give it a try. Sojourner Truth did attend a women's rights meeting in Akron, Ohio in 1851. Uh-huh. And she did speak up. And she did say that she had worked like a man and she could eat as much as a man when she could get it. She right. did say that women deserve their rights, and she deserved her rights because she was a working woman.
But according to the accounts, according to the best evidence that you've yes. got as a historian, we have really, blown this thing? We've made of it more symbol than substance.
Well, that's not an accident. First of all, Sojourner Truth, when Isabella became Sojourner Truth on Pentecost in 1843, she was making herself into a symbol right there. That name says, I am more than simply one mortal. So she had written, or rather dictated, because she didn't read and write, she had dictated her narrative, and she was going around to anti-slavery and feminist audiences to sell her narrative. So she was twice over.
She was on a book tour.
Yes, indeed.
She
was on a book tour.
Fair enough.
So she went to this meeting, and she did speak up, and someone was writing down what she said when she said it. So the gist of what we know seems to be what she said. However, the form in which we know it comes from 1863, not from 1851. Frances Dana Gage, who chaired the meeting in 1851, wrote down her version of what happened 12 years after the fact.
And as a historian, you're not inclined necessarily to trust that.
Well, for two reasons. One is that she was obviously responding to Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Right.
And there are echoes of Stowe's article, Sojourner Truth, the Libyan Sibyl, which appeared a couple of weeks before Gage's. So there are echoes of Stowe in Gage. And secondly, I've been able to read the anti-slavery newspaper that ran the call, that covered the meeting, that talked about what was going on at the time, and the accounts don't jibe.
Would you say, Nell Painter, that Sojourner Truth shaped her times, or was the object of a shaping process of her times?
It was both, of course. What's interesting is that Sojourner Truth, or Isabella, or both, were involved in the various religious controversies and tendencies of her time. So her first religious formation was very conventional, Dutch Reformed. I think she probably did not go to church, as most country people did not, until she was emancipated. And then she chose her own church, which was a Methodist church, with a holiness persuasion, perfectionist persuasion. And when she moved to New York, she belonged to one of innumerable little groups of come-outers, if you wish, people who had left conventional churches and founded their own societies. So this was happening all over the North at the time that she was becoming a perfectionist.
Well, does the religion leave the imprint on the politics, or is it the other way around? If the religion comes first for Sojourner Truth, and the
religion does come first,
and then the political agenda emerges from that, what we have is a shaping force that that puts the imprint of Christianity onto issues of race and women's issues in roughly 1850 forward.
But the reason that Sojourner Truth was so successful was that her fellow feminist abolitionists were thinking much the same thing. They did not. They were not all perfectionists, but they believed in God. They just didn't believe in conventional religion, which they thought was corrupt.
Let's pause on, as you say, the relationship, or as you're implying here, the relationship between Sojourner Truth and the people who stood for abolitionism and women's rights. The conventional or the received notion here in our own time, in the we look back 30 years to the 60s, is that the civil rights movement is anything but monolithic, that we have a lot of conflict, we have a lot of negotiation, competing forces going on. Is it fair to say that that was the same case in the times of Sojourner Truth? That is to say, people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and William Lloyd Garrison and these, even Abraham Lincoln, these large figures that we associate with emancipation and with feminism, what was the nature of the battle like?
Well, the first line of battle, I would say, was over women's rights in 1840. Should women be able to join, lead, and speak in anti-slavery groups, which led to a split in the anti-slavery ranks? And then there was a question in the 40s about whether or not there should be political action or whether abolitionists should stand back from politics. William Lloyd Garrison, who was probably the most influential of the abolitionists, felt that abolitionists should have no truck with politics. But someone like Frederick Douglass was very happy to see the Liberty Party and the Republican Party, mm-hmm. and threw his lot in with Republicans, and after the Civil War became an elder statesman among Republicans.
What was the relationship like, Nell Painter, between Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass? Here are these two monuments
that we
look back at, and give us the sort of inside historian scoop here.
Well, the first thing is that they did meet. And I can't tell exactly how much they met on the lecture trail, because until Harriet Beecher Stowe made Sojourner Truth visible, she was often there and people did not remark. But they did meet in the Northampton Association for Education and Industry, which was Sojourner Truth's second of three communes. Hmm. And Sojourner Truth does not leave any testimony about her relations or her friendship or whatever with Frederick Douglass, but Douglass did. And he said that when he would go to the Northampton Association, this would be in the mid-40s, that he was trying to make himself into a statesman. And you can sort of picture young Frederick Douglass, this handsome young man,
right.
walking around proclaiming the Columbian orator to the trees and the fields, and sort of practicing up right. being a speaker and manipulating politics of the day. Now, Frederick Douglass was making himself into a gentleman reformer, so reading was important to him, and his personal self-presentation as a gentleman was important. Now, Sojourner Truth's approach was very different. While Frederick Douglass thought it was crucial to read and write and to do that elegantly and mm-hmm. thoroughly, Sojourner Truth had other ways of knowing. She did not read and write. She heard directly from the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit told her what to do and say, and she saw no reason to do all this practicing. So Douglass said that she would make fun of him and try to trip him up, and I think he didn't appreciate it very much.
How do you want, for lack of a better term, public perception? What course would you have that take when it comes to the life of this terribly complex and yet vastly oversimplified person that you've written about?
Well, you've summed it up right there. I would like my readers to come away with the understanding that people we can sum up in a few words, whether it's Sojourner Truth or George Washington or Betsy Ross or mm-hmm. Any of these sort of larger-than-life figures, that there's more going on, and that to use them to stand for something, strong black women say, is not to understand that person in that person's lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I know that my Sojourner Truth probably hasn't a snowball's chance in hell to displace the sort of larger-than-life Sojourner Truth. But I'd like people to know that we use symbolic figures for our needs, not necessarily because our needs correspond with what the life of the particular figure was at the time.
Nell Irvin Painter is the author of Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol, recently published by Norton. Nell Irvin Painter is a professor of history at Princeton University. Her other books include Standing at Armageddon and The Narrative of Hosea Hudson. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, another conversation for Black History Month 1997. Literary scholar John Sikora is here to talk about his new book, A Biography of Frederick Douglass.
Everybody agrees that he was probably the most important black figure, African-American figure of the whole 19th century. Hmm. The writers of obituaries for him when he died in 1895 said that there were two previous black names, figures who might compare, Toussaint Louverture and Alexander Dumas. Hmm. But in point of contributions, nobody equaled him. Martin Luther King is known for the speeches and organizing efforts of about, 8-9 years.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm X is known for the speeches of about 6 years. Frederick Douglass gave electrifying speeches for 55 years.
Literary scholar John Sikora. His new book is a biography of Frederick Douglass, the 19th century African-American orator, journalist, fugitive slave, and abolitionist. John Sikora is a professor of English at North Carolina Central University.
There is in his life something of a model for everyone, black, white, Croatian, Anglo, any kind of thing. There is a great deal to this man who didn't have a single day of formal education in his life, but was probably the most powerful orator in the greatest period of oratory in American history.
You make a guess at what he would have sounded like? How do you put that evidence together?
Oh, that's
together?
Easy. James Earl Jones to the ninth power.
Uh-huh.
James Earl Jones in voice and presence, and I'm trying to think in terms of dignity. he was remarkable. All of the great speakers, Emerson, Sumner, Stevens, Abraham Lincoln, mm-hmm. Stephen Douglas, who heard him, said that he was the best they had ever heard.
Tell us about how he makes his way from slavery to freedom. You mentioned the year 1838. There's a sort of a crystallizing episode. He steps off of or onto a bridge in New York. What was that all about?
Oh, my. 1838 was a very big year for him. He decided that he had to be free. He decided how he should do it, and he decided to marry. He married in the same year Anna Murray Douglas, who was his wife for nearly 44 years.
Mm.
But on that fateful day, he left Baltimore disguised as a seaman with not free papers exactly, but a seaman's paper. To be a black seaman, one had to be free.
Mm.
And so he, in a sense, again, for more than the second time in his life, sort of wrote his own papers. But he borrowed the papers from a friend, another black seaman, and used them to show several railroad conductors, ferry conductors.
My goodness.
I think he took three trains and five ferries to go from Baltimore to Wilmington, to Philadelphia, to Havre de Grasse, then to New York City.
Now, John, you say that he wrote his own papers, created his own papers. That's a wide open door here to talk about biography and autobiography. After a fashion, what we've been saying is that Frederick Douglass created his life. He not only did that by living it, but he also did it by writing about it. Give us a sense of that.
In a sense, there isn't that much distinction. I think he would agree with Boswell that one should not live more than one can write. he was a remarkable talent. He paid 50 cents when he was 11 years old to buy the Columbian Orator, which was one of the school texts of speech and oratory of the early 19th century. He memorized it. He spoke aloud each of the many speeches, and fortunately for all of us, one of those was an anti-slavery speech that he never forgot. He thought of oratory as Cicero did, that oratory was power. It was more than words. It was words plus action, words that made action flow. And he saw the writing of autobiography as virtually indistinguishable from the actions described.
Why did he present us with various and varying versions of his life? I mean, at least two titles come here to mind: the narrative of Frederick Douglass, and then what is it? My bondage and my freedom.
That's 10 years later.
Right.
The first one, 1845, the narrative. Many people would say is about as great a book as published in the 19th century. It's a gem of a book, a diamond. It's short, not much more really than 100 pages in the original edition, a long essay divided, in a sense, arbitrarily into chapters, but it was written more or less under the auspices of William Lloyd Garrison and his American Anti-Slavery Society.
Mm-hmm.
At least, I would say, half of its organizational tone and the content was determined by the society, not by Frederick Douglass himself. 10 years later, with My Bondage and My Freedom, in 1855, this came 7 years after Douglass had not really broken, but bent his relationship with Garrison. Mm-hmm. 7 years after he had been editing his own newspaper, the North Star, 7 years of, in a sense, being his own person. This new biography is at least twice as long. It has manifold physical differences. He controls its topography. He controls its editorial content. For simple things, he wasn't really permitted to do frontispieces earlier with his own photograph.
Mm-hmm.
That was thought to be affected.
And in the second time
around. Second one, the first thing you see is his own photograph.
What I hear you saying is that you have an enormous amount of collaboration, and at the same time, you've got a lot of tension and contradiction. The apparent friendly party may, in fact, be something of a hostile party in these relationships.
Yes. What the white anti-slavery workers did not altogether understand, and the black didn't either for a while, was that the people like Wendell Phillips and William Lloyd Garrison were accustomed to trained, cultivated New England types.
Mm-hmm.
All, by definition, all the former slaves were uncultivated Southern types.
You can't get away from these white males, live or dead, can you, John? I mean, they're these sort of manipulative.
Well, it wasn't just that. The person most biased against Douglas was Maria Weston Chapman, who was the secretary of the Anti-Slavery Society, and she was very definitely female, and she didn't like Douglas very much.
Tell us parenthetically and quickly, John Sikora, about the women in Douglas's life. Do you study him in your biographical work from the standpoint of the gender buzz issues that are floating around in scholarship these days?
In one sense, you can't miss them.
Uh-huh.
Douglas's greatest friends, his longest-lasting friends, were all female. Betsy Bailey, Amy Post, Otelia Ussing, all of them were female. Male friends lasted less than half the time.
Right.
His female friends did. And so there's no way to get away. You don't study them exactly with the buzz, the buzz tones. He knew his mother, and he knew and loved his grandmother. His grandmother gave him a joie de vivre that he never lost. No male ever gave him that. So his friendships with males were different. They were shorter. They weren't half so intense.
Right.
And of course, he was as free with white women as he was with black. He was never as free with white men as he was with black.
Do you have another story, for example, John, another sort of Douglas moment that comes to mind in all of the episodes, and not to say the trivia, but the small points that you have studied and learned about this man?
Let me tell you a quick story. Right after Abraham Lincoln was elected, Douglas wanted to have a kind of celebratory meeting that would also be a commemoration of John Brown, who had died a year before. It met in Boston, the most anti-slavery big city in the United States. But as soon as he got there in the morning, the mayor of Boston, a man with two resonant names, Frederick Lincoln Jr., came with a bunch of thugs and tried to throw the abolitionists out.
Mm.
They spent probably the best part of 8 hours trying to throw Frederick Douglass out. They pulled him by the hair, pulled off his clothes, tore clothing, hit him several times, but he was unbudgeable.
So we use a word like willpower and resistance. Exactly. in the deepest personal sense.
That's true. He was a caulker on ships in Baltimore before he escaped. And so he was a very strong man, and he couldn't be wrenched free from these chairs.
Uh-huh.
And probably at one time there were 50 different white men trying to throw him out of Tremont Temple, and they failed.
John, you not only write about Frederick Douglass, you teach him in the sense that you are one of the authorities in the modern literary landscape on slave narratives. We have just a moment here. Tell us quickly about why Douglass is important in that sense. We're talking about a literary form, are we not?
America has always endeared itself to stories of captivity from the earliest Puritans on. Mm-hmm. And it so happens that during the early part of the 19th century, the most prominent captives in the whole of the United States were slaves, like Frederick Douglass, like Harriet Jacobs. That kind of story has always been important. The main metaphors from political campaigns to stories of our history have been slavery, captivity, imprisonment.
And he helped, in effect, to create this as a form.
Many people would say that Frederick Douglass provided the form for most African-American prose of the 19th century as well as the 20th century, that from Douglass's narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass in 1845 to Toni Morrison's Beloved, that form of the autobiography and the form in which he presented it, those have been the dominant literary patterns, not just for black writers, but for many white writers like Twain, like Faulkner, too.
John Sikora is the author of Frederick Douglass, a biography published last year by Twain. John Sikora is a professor of English at North Carolina Central University in Durham, North Carolina. His other work includes the Frederick Douglass Encyclopedia, forthcoming from Greenwood Press. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were Nell Irvin Painter of Princeton University and John Sikora of North Carolina Central University. For an audio tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 853. Visit our site on the World Wide Web at nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week, part two of Soundings for Black History Month 1997. Join me for conversations featuring sociologist William Julius Wilson of Harvard University and literary scholar David Smith of Williams College. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a weekly cultural affairs radio service of the National Humanities Center.